I'd like to thank you for coming. It's a thrill to have you all here today. I won't introduce our speaker. In fact, I'm going to introduce the person who will introduce our speaker. And that, Lynch is your surname. I just looked at your given name 2 seconds ago and I'm mixing up. At the end of the talk, Edward Rudhauser is going to thank our speaker. And before our talk, our representative from Killam, Kevin Lynch, is going to say a few words about the Killam itself and about our speaker. And so without further ado and any further mistakes from me, here he is.
Thank you very much. I obviously need no introduction and got none. I'm really pleased to be here representing the four Killam kind of trustees. Those who know me, I'm a retired public servant and a trainee kind of banker at 62 and a lapsed economist and have been for much of my career. I'm a Killam trustee, I think, largely because I come from Nova Scotia and a small town, which is a characteristic of the trustees. I have three jobs to do today. First is to thank all of you for attending today's lecture. The part of the Killam program is the belief that not only should we support great science in Canada, but we should also support the public presentation and discussion of great science. And you are going to hear some really great science today. So thank you for attending it. Part of the value of this is not just the enormously provocative speech that Professor Hinton is going to give us, but also kind of what you take away from it. And I must say that amongst the five talks, I think Jeffrey kind of wins the prize for the most interesting kind of title, Brains, Sex, and Machine kind of learning. And we'll probably have a contest for that next year. Second, my task is to give you a little bit of a sense on kind of the background of the Killams. Who here in the room has any idea what the Killam Trust kind of is? Anybody? Two are conflicted down front. It's interesting. Three hands went up, one of whom works with a related institution. The Killam Trust was Canada's largest private philanthropy when it was set up in 1965. And it was set up by two extraordinary Canadians, Isaac Walton Killam, who was born in 1885, poor, in Yarmouth, Nova Scotia. And he married Dorothy Killam, who came from St. Louis, Missouri. She was born about the same time. And they both lived and worked here in Montreal. And he was an innovator in finance. In fact, in many ways, he invented the Canadian Merchant Bank. He established four of our largest hydropower facilities, two of them in Alberta and two of them here in Quebec that eventually became part of Hydro-Quebec. He also started four of our largest pulp and paper companies. So he was an innovator and he was a builder. And when he died in 1955, he was Canada's richest man. He was also probably the least well-known Canadian of his generation. When he died, and part of the link to the Canada Council is that he died with an estate valued at $100 million, it's rumored that he went to see the famous Minister of Industry, C.D. Howe at the time, and said, I could leave a will, and I could have some really, really good tax lawyers work on that, and I would pay very little tax, or I could die without a will, and the Government of Canada would get half of it, and I'm willing to look at the latter case, provided that you commit to setting up something like the Canada Council for the Arts. And the government actually agreed, and with the estate, the tax duties from Mr. Killam's estate and from another extraordinary Canadian, actually the Canada Council for the Arts was launched, and it has done so much for research and other things in Canada. Mrs. Killam died 10 years later in 1965, and on her death, and she had rebuilt the estate completely, she set up the Killam kind of trust. Today, the Killam Trusts are about $420 million. They're twice the size of the Rhodes, and they're almost as large as the Nobel Prize Trust. Since 1965, the Killam Trusts have actually supported the work, either doctoral, postdoctoral, or research, of over 7,000 kind of researchers. Part of the association and the monies also are with the Canada Council, and that's the prize we're seeing today. I want to, though, kind of give, I think it's one of the most extraordinary trusts and gifts that we've ever seen in the country and for the time. And this was the paragraph in the will of Mrs. Killam. This is written in 1965. Canada wasn't the same in 1965 as it is today. And she said, quote, "My purpose in establishing the Killam Trust is to help in the building of Canada's future by encouraging advanced study, thereby a hope in some small measure to increase the scientific and scholastic attainments of Canadians, to develop and expand the work of Canadian universities, and to promote sympathetic understanding between Canadians and the peoples of other countries." That's pretty thoughtful and far-reaching for 1965, and it hasn't been replicated many times since. So that's actually the basis and the thought, and it's not just the financial contribution. I think it's actually the insights. The third task I have tonight, and it's probably the most pleasurable, is to introduce one of the five 2012 Killam Prize winners. The Killam Prizes are administered by the Canada Council for the Arts. The Killam Prizes, the five of them, are Canada's leading prizes for career achievement in the fields of humanities, engineering, natural science, health science, and social sciences. And it really is kind of the kind of mark of having done an enormous amount in your field. And tonight, we actually are really, really, really pleased to have one of Canada's truly great kind of researchers in the field of engineering, but particularly machine learning and artificial intelligence, one of the five 2012 Killam Prize winners, Professor Jeffrey Hinton. And I went on the University of Toronto kind of website, and when Professor Hinton was actually interviewed on the award, said, quote, "I have two goals. One is to create machines that are better at learning, at things like recognizing objects and recognizing speech. The other is to understand how the human brain does it." So there's an engineering goal and there's a scientific goal, and Professor Hinton is going to describe how both of them come together for us here tonight. Professor Hinton came to the University of Toronto's Computer Science Department in 1987, I believe, after a PhD from the University of Edinburgh and stints at Sussex University, the University of California, and Carnegie Mellon. In 1998, he spent 3 years setting up the GADSBE Computational Neuroscience Unit at University College London before returning to U of T in 2001. Professor Hinton holds the title University Professor, which is the highest honor that the University of Toronto bestows on its faculty. He has been honored with memberships in the Royal Societies of Canada and the United Kingdom and many, many other awards, including the Hertzberg Gold Medal. Please join with me in actually welcoming our speaker tonight, Professor Jeffrey Hinton, who is going to amaze us with the magic of science. Professor?
Well, thank you very much for the introduction. I guess I don't have the option of giving a boring talk now. The theme of this talk is going to be that there's two very interesting puzzles in biology, and that these two puzzles appear to have nothing to do with one another, but actually the solution to both puzzles may be the same. And it may be an idea that comes out of trying to make machine learning work better. So I'm going to start with the puzzles. There's the problem of sexual reproduction, which is that you have genes that are well co-adapted to each other. They've learned to work well together. And now you go and take half the genes from one parent, this is a fairly simplistic view, and half the genes from another parent, and some of those genes won't be so well co-adapted. So you messed up the co-adaptation of the genes. And that will make things work worse, you'd have thought. On naive grounds, it would be better just to do cloning. That is, just to take the genes of one parent and maybe make a few mutations. That way you will save the co-adaptations. And so it's a puzzle in evolutionary biology. Why messing up co-adaptations doesn't mean that sexual reproduction is a bad thing. So the first question is, what's the point of sex? Of course, when you start asking that question, you realize you're probably fairly old. The second issue is to do with neural communication. So if you look at the neurons in your cortex, where you do most of your thinking, It appears that they communicate by sending spikes of activity that are randomly timed. That is, a neuron gets input from other neurons. The input determines its probability of sending a spike over any short interval, but then the actual emission of spikes is a random process, so you can't tell exactly when they're going to occur. You'd have thought by now neuroscientists actually know the answer to this question, but it's still a contentious question. Most of the evidence, though, shows that in most cortical neurons, it's stochastically timed spikes. And this seems crazy. Your cortex is designed, a lot of it, the perceptual parts, for doing signal processing. And we know how to do signal processing. You use real numbers and a whole bunch of engineering. And if you told an engineer, I'm going to try and do high-quality signal processing without using real numbers, I'm going to use stochastic binary numbers, bits that are unreliable, instead of using a reliable analog value, which I could use if I wanted to, they'd think you were crazy. So you could send spikes at precise times, and we know the brain can do that. When you localize using your two ears, you're using the relative times of arrival of things in the two ears by sending spikes in the opposite directions and seeing where they cross. We know that in your hippocampus, you can, or in a rat's hippocampus at least, you have cells that turn on when the rat's in a particular part of the maze, and the precise phase at which they fire tells you where within that little part of the maze the rat is. So we know that spike timing can be used by cortex, but it appears not to use it in the perceptual system, and that appears to be crazy. And I'm going to try and answer both those questions with the same idea. So let's first look at the standard explanation of why cortical neurons don't use spike timing. The first is the idea that there's no efficient way for them to do it. It's too hard an engineering problem. But that's got to be nonsense, because we know they sometimes do it, like in telling the direction of a sound. The second is that evolution just didn't figure it out. Well, it's had hundreds of millions of years to do this. It's an important problem. And I think if evolution can turn the same cells into teeth and eyeballs, I mean, if it can do that, if it wanted to send precisely timed spikes, it could. We know it does it in some places, so why doesn't it? Incidentally, if there's anybody here from the US, the alternative theory is that God just didn't figure it out. He only had a few days rather than hundreds of millions of years, but it's the same problem. So, let's go to machine learning. In the 80s, people in machine learning, or actually psychologists, copied some stuff that had been going on in control theory without knowing it. And they develop neural nets where you put in the input here, you have some layers of feature detectors, you get outputs here, and so the input might be the pixels of an image, and the desired outputs might be the classes of object in the image. And so you put in an input, you start with random weights on the connections, so this neuron here will get this activity times this weight, plus this activity times this weight, plus this activity times this weight, it'll add it all up. And if it gets above zero, significantly above zero, it might send out a spike. Or in the models, it'll actually send out a real number. That goes to the next layer and so on. When you get to the outputs, you compare what came out with the right answer, which means somebody needs to know the right answer and tell this neural network what the right answer is. And if there's any difference between what came out and the right answer, you take that difference and you send it backwards through the network. I'm not going to go into the calculus of that, but there's some simple calculus, so you can send it backwards through the network in just the way the brain doesn't, and you can figure out how to change each of these connection strengths so that next time you present that input, you're more likely to get the right answer. And that algorithm is called backpropagation. And we were very optimistic when we developed this that we'd be able to learn all sorts of fancy things like this, because we could learn multiple layers of feature detectors now, and people hadn't been able to do that before. The outcome was a bit disappointing. But since then, several things have happened. Computers have got a lot faster, like a million times faster. And data sets have got a lot bigger, like a million times bigger. And we found much better ways to initialize the weights. So instead of starting with small random values, we can do another kind of learning to initialize the weights. And as a result of all those three factors, we can now make neural networks that learn a lot better than they did in the 80s. So here's some propaganda for neural networks, for the neural network learning algorithms we have now. In speech recognition, what you need to do is take a sound wave. You need to apply a method called Fourier analysis to figure out how much energy there is at various frequencies in that sound wave. And that'll allow you to use something called a spectrogram. Then normally you do some more processing on the spectrogram, and in a way that was developed over many years. And then you feed that to a modeling technique called Gaussian mixture models. And the Gaussian mixture models are models of what little bits of a phoneme sound like. And you look to see which of your models likes what it saw the most, and you say, well, it's probably that little bit of that phoneme. But it might be some other little bits of some other phonemes, because some other models quite liked it. And then you have post-processing that puts all those bets together and tries to figure out what the most probable utterance was, using models of what kinds of phonemes come after what other kinds of phonemes. So that's called a language model. And that was the standard speech recognition technology for about 30 years. Fairly recently, we tried a new kind of deep neural network on that. So back in the 90s and late 80s, a number of people realized that neural networks ought to be good at this, and some of them even did their thesis on that. And they managed to do pretty well at this. They managed to do just about as well as the standard speech recognition systems. But they didn't manage to beat them by a whole lot, and so they didn't replace the existing technology. But neural nets have got better since then, because computers have got faster and data sets have got bigger. And so the neural nets we have now with multiple layers, some with as many as 8 layers of feature detectors, can do better than these Gaussian mixture models at looking at some coefficients extracted from the sound wave and making bets about which part of which phoneme that is. And so in about 2009, it became clear these nets were going to win. And over the next 3 years, people in industry developed them further. People initially at Microsoft and then at IBM and at Google. And they've now basically taken over. All those three research groups now believe in this method rather than the previous method. And if you have an Android phone with the Jelly Bean with the Android 4.1 operating system, that is the first Android phone to have really good speech recognition, and that's using one of our neural nets. So the people at Google took this net, they developed it further, they made it work quite a lot better, and it's now a very good speech recognizer. And they're still getting better all the time, because this is a new technology, so there's plenty of room for improvement. So when you use your Android phone, it's not that it runs a neural net in the Android phone. The phone isn't quite big enough for that yet. The phone sends information about what you said to the cloud, and then many computers on the cloud run this neural net, which makes predictions about which bit of which phoneme you were just saying, and then it all gets put together, and it figures out you were asking, you know, can you find me an English restaurant in Montreal? And instead of saying, why would you want an English restaurant, it shows you where one is, if there is one. So, it's beginning to work for technology. So the question is there anything these big deep neural networks can't do? Because that speech recognition problem is quite tricky. And there's one thing that it appears very difficult to do with big deep neural networks, because they take a long time to train. So if you want to win a machine learning competition, the way to do it is to develop many different models and average their predictions. Economists know this. If some national bank wants to predict just how badly the economy is going to go downhill, they don't ask one expert. Well, I don't think they do. I think they ask a bunch of experts and average what they're going to say. And on the whole, that works better. And in all the machine learning competitions, if you want to win, you take a bunch of different models, you train each one as well as you can, and then you average their predictions, and you'll do a little bit better. Sometimes a lot better. But the problem is, training one of these big neural networks is slow, so it's going to take a long time to train a whole lot of them. And an even worse problem is, at test time, when you're given a new example, you want to get the answer fast. Maybe Google could afford to train thousands of different neural networks for doing speech recognition, but it couldn't afford to run thousands of them at test time. And so the problem is, how can we do this averaging of many different models if we're using neural nets, which are expensive to train? And as we're going to see, answering this problem is going to explain both sex and stochastic spikes in the brain. So first of all, I want to talk about two different ways of averaging models. So suppose we've got some models that are making predictions, and we show these models a particular input, and let's suppose we're trying to recognize objects and images. So model A, let's suppose we've just got two models, to keep that simple. Model A says, I think the probability that it's class 1 is 0.3, and the probability that it's class 2 is 0.2, and the probability of class 3 is 0.5. And fortunately for us, those add up to 1. And model B thinks it's much more likely to be class 2. And so what do you do if you have two experts who are saying that? Well, you average their probabilities. That's one way to average. So the average of those two is 0.2, and the average of those two is 0.5. So our committee says we think the probabilities of the classes looks like that. And that has a nice guarantee with it, which is there's a measure that says that you're much better off using the opinion of the committee than you are picking one expert at random. It might be there's an expert who's better than the committee, but if you pick experts at random, the chances are you'll do better by picking the committee. So that's a nice guarantee to have. But there's a different way to average models. Instead of adding up the probabilities and dividing, so taking an arithmetic mean, you can take a geometric mean. So you would multiply the two numbers together and then take the square root. It'd be the nth root if there are n models. And so we get these numbers. Now those numbers don't add up to 1. So we have to normalize. We take the sum of all those numbers and divide by that sum, and then we'll get some numbers that add up to 1. And so that's a geometric mean of our experts. That's a somewhat different way of doing business, because this says if there's one expert who says the chance of this happening is 0, it really could not happen, then that can veto all the other experts. The other experts can like it as much as they like, but once you multiply it by 0, you've got a 0. If the different experts all have opinions about what can't possibly happen, and for everything that might happen, one expert says is impossible, you've got a problem. But the point about multiplying things together is experts can veto things. They can say they're very unlikely, and that can have a big effect. Here, people can't veto things. Okay. This also has the same guarantee. If you take these geometric means and you compare them with the truth, this is a better bet than picking one expert at random. Okay, so I'm actually going to use this method of model averaging because it's easier to use for the technique I'm going to describe. This is the usual method to use, but both of them work fine. So, here's a little neural net. It's just got one layer of feature detectors. We have an input where we might put an image. We have an output where we have various units to say what the various classes of objects that might be in that image. And we have a layer of feature detectors. And what we're going to do in this network is, each time I show it an input, I'm going to take my feature detectors, and at random, I'm going to throw away half of them. That seems like a bizarre thing to do. But I'm going to do it anyway. I throw away half of them, and then I train the net on that example. So that means I've got a different architecture each time I put in an example. And if there's a large number of feature detectors here, I'll never pick the same set twice. So every time I give it a new example, or even the same example again, I'll be using a different architecture, a different subset of the feature detectors. But whenever I use a feature detector, I always use the same weights. That is, the weights that I've learned connecting this feature detector to these pixels, they're going to be the same. They're going to slowly evolve with learning, but they're going to be the same whenever I use that particular feature detector. So that technique is called dropout. And for now, we'll just drop things with a probability of a half. I actually thought of this idea in about 2003, and I was inspired by CIBC. So I used to bank at a local branch of CIBC, which they then closed down for my greater convenience. And every 6 months or so, the tellers would all change. And so one day I got fed up with this, and I asked a teller, why do the tellers change every 6 months? And she said, I don't know, but they just move us around all the time. And I thought about this for a long time, because it's crazy. I mean, the customers don't like it. And I realized, it's probably to prevent conspiracies. So if you want to defraud the bank, what you'd do is you'd have a customer and a teller, or maybe a bunch of tellers, and if they knew each other, they'd be much better at defrauding the bank than if they didn't. And so if you wanted to prevent that, you'd move them around. So that gave me an idea that if you have things that work together all the time, they'll form conspiracies. And if you want to get rid of conspiracies, what you do is you just randomly leave things out all the time. You always have different subsets working together. And maybe if you can prevent conspiracies, these networks will work better. And it turns out that's true, and that's true kind of big time. So we could think of this as inspired by CIBC. What we're doing is we're randomly sampling, if there's 8 units here, we're randomly sampling from 2 to the h different architectures. Now you can think of this as a form of model averaging, because each of these different architectures is a different model. What's interesting about these models is each model only ever gets trained on one example, which doesn't seem a lot to train a model on, especially if the model has, say, 500 million parameters. Seems rather a lot to expect to train 500 million parameters on one example. But the models all share parameters. Whenever a hidden unit's used, one of these feature detectors, it's used with the same parameters on all the different training examples. So that regularizes the parameters. And basically, it's a much better regularizer than the standard ones are. So a regularizer is something, it's a sort of penalty you put on parameters when you're trying to fit a model that has more parameters than the amount of data you have. Like, for example, suppose you're trying to put a line through 3 data points, and you allow yourself a high-order polynomial that can have lots of wiggles in it. Well, that can always go through 3 data points, but that doesn't mean much. But if you put a regularizer and say, you have to not wiggle much, then when you put it through 3 data points, it'll mean more. So normally in these neural nets, you put in a regularizer that says, keep all the weights as small as you can. Just keeping them small isn't a very good regularizer. But keeping them the same as the weights in other models that are also making use of this feature detector is a much better regularizer. So one question is, if we train it by randomly dropping units, what do we do at test time? Well, we could take a test example, and we could run it through and drop some units and see what the predictions are. And then we could run it through again and drop some more units and see what the predictions are. And we could do that 100 times, and we could average. But it turns out we can get the same result in a much simpler way. At test time, you don't drop any of the units. You just halve the outputs of each unit. So if we go back to this model, then if you drop this unit with a probability of 0.5, you're only getting his outputs half the time. But you can get the same expected value by using them all the time and halving the outgoing weights. So that's what we do at test time. And that will exactly compute the geometric mean of all possible models, all 2 to the h models. If you have more than one hidden layer, then when you halve the outgoing weights, it doesn't exactly compute the geometric mean, but it's very close. If you try running it a few hundred times and averaging, you get pretty much the same results as you'd get by just halving the outgoing weights. And of course, halving the outgoing weights is much faster. So we now have a way of training a big neural net by just dropping out half the units. And that's like training many different models all at the same time. And we have a way of using it at test time, which involves just running once through the neural net with weights that are half the size. So we can make it faster at test time. We can actually do the same for the input layers. We can leave out some of the inputs. And Yoshio Benjo's group at the University of Montreal was doing that some time ago. They call that denoising autoencoders. And this is essentially the same trick, but just generalized to the feature detectors as well as the input units. So the question is, how well does this trick work? And the answer is, it makes neural nets work a whole lot better. They just do much better at predicting things. In particular, it kills what's called the overfitting problem. The overfitting problem is when you try and fit a model that has lots of parameters to not much data, it'll fit the data very well, but it won't generalize. Like if I have a few points and I fit a wiggly line through them, I can make the wiggly line go exactly through the points, but then the line will wiggle off over here, and you can't really believe what it says over there. That's the overfitting problem. We can basically solve that problem for neural nets by using this dropout technique, and that allows us to use huge numbers of parameters, even if we don't have much training data. And so now, if your neural net isn't overfitting, you should be using a much bigger one and use dropout. And big nets with dropout work much better than small nets. So let's see how much better. First, we tried it on speech recognition. So we already had things that were very good. So the things that Google developed further, on a standard benchmark, which is small enough to run in a university, we were getting 22.7% error. We added this dropout technique. So the way this works is you first learn feature detectors in a magic unsupervised way I'm not going to talk about, and then you use this backpropagation algorithm for fine-tuning all the feature detectors, and you get 22.7 error on your test set. If you fine-tune it with dropout, you get 19.7, and that's a big difference. At the time, that was a record for methods that aren't told who the speaker is. Since then, people have done better. If you look at the curves, this is not how well you do at predicting the whole phoneme. This is how well you do at predicting individual little bits of the phoneme. So that's why this axis is a bit different. So this is your classification error on little bits of the phoneme. And if you train a neural net in the normal way, what you see is a curve like this black one here that comes down and goes up again. When it goes up again, that's called overfitting. What I'm looking at here is, as a function of how long I've trained it for, how many times I've swept through the test set, updating the parameters, I'm looking at how well the neural network predicts the answers. And lower is better. So the neural network's getting better, then it starts getting worse, and then it plateaus. So if we stopped it early, we could have stopped there, and that would be the best net for a net that had three layers of 4,000 neurons. But if we use dropout, then all of the lines, they come down and they stay down. And they're at a much lower level than these. So we're getting much lower errors. And it's basically killed the overfitting. Now let's go to object recognition. So back in the 80s, one of the primary tasks for neural nets was to do object recognition. And we were very hopeful that they would be able to find multiple layers of features, where low-level features would be things like a little piece of edge, and high-level features would be combinations of edges like corners, then high-level features would be little familiar combinations of things like an eye or a nose or something, then high-level you have a face and so on. And we thought learning layers of features like this would be the right way to do object recognition. And it didn't work very well. Computer vision people went off and developed better systems. And in the end, computer vision people developed systems that did quite well. And they weren't neural nets. And they said, look, your neural nets are no good, because our computer vision systems work better. And then, fortunately for us, the computer vision people eventually came up with a training set where they had a million images, and the images were moderately well labeled. So for each image, they'll tell you the label of the main object in the image. Now, that label is put in by a person who's paid something like a nickel, and the labels aren't very reliable, and they're drawing from 1,000 categories, so there's no way of knowing for sure what label they will give it. I'll show you some examples in a minute. And so you allow your system to have 5 bets, and if in the 5 bets it gets the label the person put in, you say you got it right. So the question is, can you get the label the person guessed in your top 5 bets? And they run this competition every year. And we'd looked at some old competitions, figured out we could beat these computer vision system people. But the good thing about this competition is they give you the test images and they don't tell you what the labels are. You have to run your software and submit your answers to them, and then they tell you how well you did. So it's very hard to cheat. You could cheat if you're willing to look at a million images yourself in a short time, but it's hard. Okay, so We trained a system using dropout on this and using a lot of other techniques for neural nets developed by Yannicka and Yoshua Benger and other people. And here's the results for that competition. So the computer vision systems, so this is the best that many years of computer vision research can do. They were quite proud of these results. What's really interesting here is they're all getting 26 to 27% error. These are the very best systems. Slightly worse systems are getting 29% error. And there are systems way down here getting 50% error. There's plenty of those. But these are the ones who were doing well on previous competitions, and they entered this competition. That's the best you can do. And they're asymptoting. And these guys predicted we wouldn't be able to do much better than that, and they said they'd be impressed if we could beat this. So here's what we did. We got 16% error. And that's hugely better. This gap here is much bigger than the gap we had in speech recognition. In speech recognition, we took the existing technology and we did slightly better, because the existing technology had had many years of development. And after we'd done slightly better, the big companies picked up on it, and other researchers picked up on it, and made it do quite a lot better. This, we got a whole lot better right off the bat. Now, when I say we, the dropout technique is probably responsible for about a third of this gap. The other two-thirds of the gap, people doing neural nets, in particular things called convolutional neural nets, had done a lot of technology to make them work well, and they just hadn't applied them to these big data sets properly yet. So let me show you, tell you a bit about the net. The net has seven layers of features, and in addition to those layers of features, there's sort of intermediate layers that pool things together, that average a few things. It takes images from the web in the training set, and it downsizes them to 256 by 256. And then within that image, it takes a smaller patch, and it tries many patches, so it gets lots more training examples. So even though there's only a million images, for a big net like this, you want many million training examples, so you use these smaller patches. And Alex also does left-right reversals. Up-down reversals would change the meaning of the image, but left-right reversals pretty much don't. So he gets even more data. And he runs this on a graphics processing unit, which has thousands of little processors in it. And he runs it for a week. He actually ran it on two of these processing units for a week. And that was a lot of computation. It couldn't have been done a few years ago, except on a supercomputer. And in the last layers, where you've got lots of parameters, he uses this dropout technique, and it helps a lot. So here's some examples of the images. And these are the test images, not the ones he trained on. That's a cheetah. In fact, I'm not certain these are the true test images, but these are ones he held back himself as a test set, I think. These are not ones he trained on. That's a cheetah, and it doesn't have any ears, and it doesn't have any legs, and it doesn't have a tail. But you know it's a cheetah, and the net knows it's a cheetah, and the net's very confident it's a cheetah. But look at its other bets. If it's not a cheetah, it's probably a leopard. And if it's not a leopard, it's a snow leopard. And if it's not that, it's an Egyptian cat. Its bets are quite sensible. Notice here the cheetah's taking most of the image. Here, this is taking maybe 10% of the image. The net's very confident it's a bullet train, even though there's this great big building and there's a roof, and there's, I think that's probably a fish tank or something, and then there's a person and a pillar. But it knows that this is sort of what the image is about, because it's been learning from the labels people assign to images. So it knows more than just doing vision. It knows the kinds of ways people label images. And its other labels are all pretty reasonable. Here's another one. That's from a catalogue, probably. And this one, it gets the right answer in its top five, but not first. It's a hand glass. If you look at its other answers, they're all pretty sensible. And if you screw your eyes up a bit, you can see how that's a frying pan. It doesn't have good enough eyesight to see that that's not a handle, that's actually a chain, right? It probably can't really see that. It thinks that might be the handle of a frying pan. So you can see its limitations. But you can see it understands a lot about visual objects because of these bets it makes. Let's do a few more because I love this. It looks at this car, and it says that's a convertible. That's what I'd have said. I think that's a good answer, but that's the wrong answer. The person labeled it grill. Well, it gets grill as its second bet. And it also thinks it might be one of those old pickups, or a beach wagon, or a fire engine, because it's red, presumably. So those are all pretty good bets. Here, it gets it wrong. It gets it wrong because it says Dalmatian. I would have got it wrong, too. Now, there is some limitations to its vision. So you know that that's not a grape or an elderberry or a currant, and you probably know it because it's got a slightly waxy appearance, more than you would have for a red currant or a grape, and also because of this stem here. And maybe this little bit here. So you know that's probably a cherry, and that was the correct label for this image. But if you look what it does, it's making a valiant attempt here. It clearly can see that in here there's a dog and there's some fruit, and maybe it's one of those two. If you look at the motor scooter here, the motor scooter isn't much of the image, and it's thoroughly obscured by people. Look, there's a perfectly good car, but it knows that the way people label images, they wouldn't have called that car. This is the object of interest, and it's got a label motor scooter, so it thinks that's probably what it is, or maybe a golf cart. Okay, it's pretty good at label images, and it's much better than any computer vision system. I think that what this means for computer vision is give up now. That is, the techniques they were using so far in computer vision, they do lots of other things in computer vision, fortunately. They track things, and they do all sorts of other things, like taking all your photos and figuring out how a town's laid out from all these holiday photos. All that stuff they're very good at. But if you want to recognize objects in images, they might as well give up. And the reason they might as well give up is because our system involved almost no hand engineering. And so as data sets get bigger and computers get faster, our system will just get better and better. And the computer vision systems will need more hand engineering, and they won't get better as faster. So the gap will get bigger and bigger, not smaller and smaller. Of course, I would say that. Let me just give you one more example. I'm getting near the end. Here's another interesting problem. I give you a bunch of properties of a molecule, and I say, will this molecule bind well to this other target site? And the big pharma companies are very interested in that. They want to know whether a molecule will bind to some drug-binding site, so it'll act as a good drug for depression or whatever. Now, they can actually take the molecule and put it in a test tube and see how well it binds, but that takes work. They do spend an awful lot on research, but they'd rather have a cheaper way to do it. In fact, they spend so much on research, their research budget is almost as big as their advertising budget. So what they'd like to do is look at the properties of the molecule and then predict whether it will bind just from the properties of the molecule. And they measured a lot of properties of molecules. And they put a public competition where they have 9,000 properties of molecules. Actually, they have 11,000. And each of the molecules have 15 different targets, and then thousands of molecules for each target. And for each of these molecules, they give you many thousands of these descriptors. And you have to predict whether it'll bind to the target. So a student of mine called George Dahl, the same guy who did the speech recognition stuff, entered this competition rather late. And he tried using neural nets for it without dropout. And as soon as he used more than about 30 feature detectors in the middle of the neural net, it started overfitting badly. So then he tried using dropout. And now he could use 500 feature detectors without much overfitting. And it worked much better. And so he won this competition. Now, in the competition, he did actually average it with other methods, because he's very sensible. After he'd won the competition, he went back and said, if I hadn't averaged it with any other methods, if I'd just used neural nets, would I have won? And the answer is yes, he would have won, just using these neural nets with dropout. So after he'd won, and Merck had paid him the $20,000 for winning, Merck said, okay, now, a condition of these $20,000 is you have to tell us how you did it. So what QSAR are you using? And George didn't know what QSAR was. So we had to look it up on Google. And QSAR is quantitative structure activity relationships. And it's what's used in the drug industry for deciding whether a molecule might bind to a target. And it's a respectable academic field that's been going for like 10 years. It has an annual conference and it has a journal. And we'd never heard of it because we just entered this competition. So if I was in that field, I'd be distinctly worried. Okay, now here's another way to think of dropout that relates back to the original motivation, the CIBC motivation, which is, if you're the feature detectors in a neural network, what you're trying to do is get the answer right. So if your neighbors for a particular input are making a wrong prediction, you're being trained to override their prediction. Because between you, you want to get it right. So it's like having a committee where, instead of the committee members just making their best bets, a committee member says, OK, I know the answer here. The answer is, it's probably going to go up. But this crazy other guy on the committee, I know he's going to say it's definitely go down. So I'm going to get the right answer to come out by saying it's definitely going to go up, even though I think it's only probably going to go up. Because when that's combined with his answer, that it's definitely going to go down, then we'll get the right answer. And it turns out committees don't work nearly as well if you do that. If you're tailoring your answer not to what you believe the truth to be, but to fixing up the problems that this other idiot is going to cause, that's going to cause huge overfitting. As soon as he changes his mind, your answer is going to be wrong. And that's what is happening during overfitting. Parameters are trying to fix up problems caused by other parameters. And you can get rid of this if you use dropout. So basically, dropout is stopping complex co-adaptations of different features. And I can make you understand this best by my advice for Al-Qaeda. So if you're an Al-Qaeda, you want a conspiracy that destroys things, and you have two choices. You could have a great big complex conspiracy with 50 conspirators, and they all play their roles just right, and you manage to blow something up. The problem is, that's all very well during training and rehearsals, but when it comes to the real thing, events aren't going to turn out quite how you expected. Things are going to be odd. Funny things will happen. And if you've got 50 people who all have to do the right bit, and it's all tailored to how things were during rehearsals, it's not going to work at test time. You're much better off having 10 groups where each group has 5 conspirators, and those 5 conspirators, maybe they don't have quite as good an effect as 50 guys, but they try and do something bad. And all these different groups, all independently, try and achieve this bad goal. And then at test time, when things aren't quite as you expect, some of them will fail, but some of them will succeed. And they're not relying on things being exactly as expected. And the issue is, it's just the same for your genes. So if we think back to sexual reproduction, if you have 50 genes that are all involved in producing the right chemical to make something happen, the right protein to make something happen, and the environment now changes, you're in trouble. If the environment stayed the same, cloning might be a very good idea. But if the environment changes, something's going to go wrong with that conspiracy. If you can use 50 genes, you're much better off having little combinations of genes, each of which achieves this thing, but in redundant ways. Then when the environment changes, some of those combinations will still work. So the whole point of sexual reproduction is to smash these big complex co-adaptations. You don't want them. They're fine if you've got a perfect model of the world, but if the environment changes, you won't be able to survive. So the idea is, the thing that evolution biologists thought was so bad about sexual reproduction, which is that it smashes up complex co-adaptations, is actually the thing that's good about it. That's the whole point of it, to do that. And the point is, you're not trying to make the organism good at the environment it's in now. You're trying to make an organism that's going to be good after the environment's changed a bit. It's just like the problem with machine learning, where you train on some data, but now you test on other data. And you want to be good on the test data, not just on the training data. If you use this dropout technique, you get worse on the training data. You just get much better on the test data. Okay. Now, there is an alternative to dropout that works just about as well. Suppose we've got feature detectors, and each feature detector computes how active it is, and then with probability a half, we throw it away. Okay. An alternative is this. Each feature detector computes how active it is, call that P, and then we send a spike of activity with that probability. In other words, we're only going to send a spike or a non-spike. It's going to be this one-bit integer we send. But we send it probabilistically. Sending a 1 with probability p is the same as sending a p with probability 1. Sending a 0.5 with probability p has the same expected value as sending p with probability 0.5. So dropout says, with probability 0.5, send this activation. But an alternative is to say, send an activation of 0.5, only send it with probability p. And that's exactly what a stochastic neuron is doing. So actually, sending stochastic spikes is very similar to dropout. And so I then tried something that people should have tried years earlier, and I don't know, people must have tried it. It's insane that they didn't. Which is, take a neural network, and when you go forwards, instead of sending this real value p, send a spike or no spike with a probability of p. So it's just one bit that goes. And the answer is, if you do that, it doesn't do as well on training data. Maybe people tried it and discovered it didn't do as well on the data you were trying to fit, but it does much better on the test data. It's like dropout. And it's actually very similar to dropout. So the argument is that dropout is a way of allowing yourself to have a very big model that doesn't overfit. By on each training example, you just leave out half your model. So you're really averaging together lots and lots of different models. And the brain is doing the same trick. So the original problem with stochastic spikes was we thought in standard engineering terms. We thought of doing signal processing with a brain. And now when an engineer does signal processing, they're trying to fit a model, typically from a well-defined class of models, like a linear dynamical system. And they're trying to fit it to data they pretty much understand. When the brain is doing this, it's just this buzzing, blooming confusion. It's no idea what's going on. And if you've no idea what's going on, you can't afford to just fit one model. What you need to do is fit a gazillion different models and average them. And so if you use neurons with stochastic spikes, that's in effect what you're doing. You're basically using the wisdom of crowds to overcome the fact that you've no idea what's going on. In your brain, you have about that many synapses. And you're losing thousands of them every second. You live for about that many seconds. And you can see this number's a lot shorter than that number. It's a ratio of nearly 100,000. So even if these numbers are a little bit wrong, and this one's not very wrong, there's a huge ratio. And if you were a statistician and I told you, okay, we've got this device and it's fitting models to data, because that's clearly what the brain is doing, only our model has 10 to the 14 parameters and we only have 2 billion training cases. Any normal statistician would say you have to be out of your mind. There's no way you can fit a model with that many parameters, that many training cases, without hopelessly overfitting. But that's what the brain does. And the reason it does it, the way it does it, is by using stochastic spikes so that it doesn't overfit. And the reason it does it is because synapses are really cheap and experiences are really expensive. And so your brain's come up with this trick of using stochastic neurons so it can throw 100,000 synapses per second at experience. Okay, I'm done. We produced a paper. You'd have thought a paper that explains why you have sex, how the brain works, how to do much better at speech recognition, how to do much better at object recognition, how to do much better at everything else would be enough to satisfy the referees. But if you tell someone as a referee, it's like putting a uniform on them. They turn into a fascist. Okay, I'm done.
So I think what I'd like to do is, on behalf of McGill University and Montreal Neurological Institute, which is another Killam Institute, to present you this gift in
Thank you very much
for coming out for this auspicious occasion.
Thanks.
And there is time for questions from the audience, and so I'll leave the podium to Professor Hinton.
Okay.
Questions? Yes, sure.
Isn't there another reason why sexual reproduction was useful for evolution, which is that combining the good things that one parent found another parent found and getting a divide and conquer?
Absolutely. So you want to have lots of people exploring to find new good genes, and then once one person's found a good gene, you want it to spread through the population. So you want mixing. Yes. And so everybody knew that sex is good for mixing, but there was always this problem of, okay, so you need it for mixing, but why isn't it bad because of breaking up complex co-adaptations? And it turns out that not all organisms use sex all the time. If you're in a very static environment, it turns out it's better to use parthenogenesis. If the environment isn't changing, some kinds of worm and stick insects and things, which have a very stable environment, they use parthenogenesis. But they always evolved from things that were using sex. But right at the end of the optimization, you switch to parthenogenesis, if the environment's not changing. Yeah. Okay, a little while ago I'd have told you, you know, putting more than about four layers is going to be a waste of time. That's partly based on experience, partly based on the fact that the pathway in the brain that recognizes shapes seems to have about half a dozen levels. It doesn't have like 100 levels. That's the infratemporal pathway. But actually, the speech thing worked best for eight layers, and since then people have done more layers. And it used to be we didn't know how to train systems that had lots of layers. But we have much better training techniques now, and we can train systems with lots of layers. So I don't know the answer anymore. It used to be four, but now I don't know. I'd still think more than 10 was sort of pushing it.
That the generative pre-training part of the process now becomes unimportant. Is there a message there, or some theory that one can predict when the pre-training is critical and when it's not?
Yeah, let me go back to the history of neural nets very quickly. We're almost there. Those are deep nets. So what happened was deep neural nets fell out of favor because other methods were working better. And then about 5 years ago, we came up with ways of training feature detectors one layer at a time without knowing the answer. That was called pre-training. And that was more like an enzyme in the sense that that got deep neural networks working. And once they were working again, people explored them more, and they discovered that if you have large sets of labeled data, like they do in speech, you didn't actually need this pre-training. It still helps a little bit, and as you get less labeled data, it helps more. So for languages where you don't have much data, it's probably much more help than languages where you do. And for tasks where you don't have much data, it's probably more help. Other tasks. But you don't actually need it. So the main developments is basically faster computers and bigger labeled data sets by themselves are enough. But people hadn't realized that until we found better ways of initializing the weights. That got us over the hurdle. And once we're over the hurdle, people could see you could do it even without initializing the weights. Cleverly. Although, for training deep nets, you do have to initialize the weights to be of roughly the right scale. If you make them the wrong scale, it's hopeless.
See, long ago, I took a great course on machine learning and a bit of neural networks that I think you taught. And there were a lot of challenge problems, I think, that came out along the way. And over the years, most of those challenge problems seem like they've been picked off, especially in the last 5 years or so. So I was wondering if you have a favorite challenge problem now that you think the community really should be worrying about, this particular community especially.
I think there's a very major problem, which is, can you take a document and give me a vector that contains the meaning of the document? And so what people do at present is they take a document, they treat it as if it was a bag of words, that is, as if the order of the words didn't matter, and that's a good way to represent documents not. You put in the word not, and it changes the meaning. And for what, for example, Google does at present, it doesn't change the meaning. That's not quite true. They use combinations of words as well a bit, I think. But basically, the big challenge now is make computer vision work better, make speech recognition work better, make everything else work better, but be able to take natural language and understand actually what people are saying. And we're going to do it eventually. And that's going to be amazing, slightly scary, because if you make a system that takes a document and understands what's being said, and if you can do it on a modern computer, or computers as they will be in 10 years' time, then that system's going to be able to sort of read a lot more than any one person could read, and so maybe it's going to end up a lot smarter than any one person. And then you have to start worrying about whether it's got access to machine guns.
Okay, so in the interest of time, and I'm sure you're tired after a very long day, I'd like to thank the audience for attending. I'd especially like to thank Mr. Kevin Lynch for coming out on behalf of the Killam Trust today for this auspicious occasion. And very much like to thank Professor Hinton for not just an excellent talk, but for resuscitating sexual reproduction as a strategy. So I think we all owe him a debt of gratitude. Thank you very much.
I'd like to finish, too, by thanking the Killam Foundation. It's an amazingly nice thing to get a big prize from the Killam Foundation. And it's also very nice to get a chance to give a public lecture like this. So I'd like to thank them very much.
Because it's also a process of trying.